Yes, sir. Reading you loud and clear. The clock has started.
Five, four, three, two, one.
Liftoff. We have a liftoff.
This week's episode of our podcast. Today we are going to interview some of the greatest and most influential minds in our field. By sharing our collective expertise, we will show you how to harness, control, and use your own skill set to achieve ultimate success and live the life you want. And now, please welcome your host.
Welcome to this week's Smallest Cast podcast. This podcast is designed for small government contractors, service providers, and manufacturers as part of the government contractor ecosystem, connecting people, organizations, and resources. I'm your host, Just Nate, and this week we are doing something a little bit different. This is the week of Thanksgiving, so first of all, happy Thanksgiving to everybody out there. I know it was past us, but at least we wanted to say thanks. So this week we are traveling up in North Dakota. On the phone, we've got Mr. Dennis Cater, our CEO. Welcome, Dennis.
Thanks, Nate. Okay. Happy Thanksgiving.
Same to you. Hopefully you got full.
Yeah, I did. Actually, I ate too much yesterday. It was bad.
I don't know how that's possible. So for those that don't know, Dennis is a vegan. So that means he doesn't eat.
I cheated. I ate some yesterday.
You're having more and more of those cheat days, Dennis. I don't know what's up with that. So, Dennis, today we are going to interview a small business out of Dickinson, North Dakota. The company's name is Elite Lift Solutions. So they work in the oil and gas fields. And with us, we have Mr. Jesse Jeffola, the operations manager. Welcome, Jesse.
Well, thanks, guys.
Okay, and we've got Mr. Brandon Cadermus, the engineering manager. Welcome, Brandon.
Hey, thanks, Nate.
Okay.
Pleased to be here.
It sounds like it. Sounds like really exciting. I'm trying not to get too much of an echo in here. So, who wants to start? I want to ask, Brandon's sitting across from me. So, Brandon, tell us what Elite Lift Solutions does.
So, Elite Lift Solutions is a small service provider here in the oil and gas industry. And in Western North Dakota, we primarily service the Bakken region. Our main focus is downhole reciprocating rod pumps, bottom hole assemblies. We basically help the operators maximize their production on their wells that are, in need of artificial lift. So basically, the long and the short of it is, oil wells, right when they're drilled, they have natural pressure built up in the reservoir. They can flow for, extended amount of time. And over time, there's what you call a depletion curve, where the pressure from the reservoir no longer is able to push that fluid to the surface. And we come in with our equipment and help that fluid come to the surface. So, you're probably used to seeing those, pump, we call them pumping units, or nodding donkeys, whatever you want to call them. They're basically pumper units that sit and they pump. Basically what they're doing is they are, moving a reciprocating rod pump that has a series of check valves, sometimes 2 miles down under the ground, wherever the pay zone is on that reservoir. Right. Well, so we sell the equipment that actually goes down in the hole and pumps the oil to the surface. So we have two locations right now. We got one in Dickinson, North Dakota, as you mentioned, and another one in Williston. Both are full service rod pump shops where we build brand new pumps. But then we also repair old ones that come in after the workover, works them over. If the well fails, the workover crew will retrieve that and then bring that used pump to our shop where we'll rebuild it and then send it back out.
Okay. So, now, do you guys have, I think you guys, you and I were talking earlier, you guys have multiple areas of expertise. It's not just the well itself, right? Or the equipment down in the well. You guys have different product lines. How many different product lines do you guys have?
Right now we have our downhole reciprocating rod pump product line, which also creates, we also make bottom hole assemblies that help filter out the sand and the gas so they don't enter into the system. Those are the two things that an oil well on artificial lift does not like, especially rod pump system, gas and sand. So we create things that'll filter those out. So that's our bottom hole section of our business. Another totally almost 180 degree swing is we do deep earth foundation driven pile systems for oil field equipment. So anything that you know would be sitting on a typical oil field location, we would have you know different equipment that would install driven piles to support that load. Depending on what we need to do, we've got the engineering capabilities to make that happen. So, yeah, those are our two main. Jesse, am I missing anything on those two? I know we've kind of looked at other different divisions, but those kind of two big ones, right?
Yeah, that's the two core product lines for Elite Lift Solutions, and you know, there's a lot of little sub product lines that go along with like the rod pumps, just a lot of different products that the customers will call on order with pumps. So we end up, you know, stocking sucker rods and miscellaneous parts and pieces for the hookup. When the customer makes the phone call, they want the pump, and then they want all the goodies to go with it. So you end up getting into a lot of different products. But yeah, the core is the pump product line, and it's probably the largest reciprocating rod market in certainly in the U.S. And there's good reason for that. It's a predominantly rod lift market. After they go from blowing, they typically rod them up, and it's a very challenging rod pump market. So it's deep, corrosive, high temperatures, crooked wells. So there's a lot of things going against it, but it's basically the number one form of lift up here, and yeah, so that's what we're focused on.
So as long as the oil and gas field holds up, you guys have unlimited customers, I guess, at this point. I forgot to mention real quick here, we do have another guest speaker with us tonight, Mr. Brad Moser. He is the city operations manager of a small town here in North Dakota. So he was along for the ride, so he might pipe in here and there. So welcome, Brad.
Hi. I do have a question already. I've been in the water industry for 35 years, and the deepest well that I've run into in the western part of the state here is about 800 feet. And I know you guys go down like 2 miles or whatever. How do you work around an aquifer down there or whatever? You go through that water when you drill?
Yeah, so good question, Brad. I'm not directly tied into the drilling side of things. Maybe Jesse can add a little bit on at the tail end of this, but basically when you're going down, you're casing around any aquifers, any critical areas to where you're not going to worry about, you know, pumping your mud or anything down and getting into those aquifers. So you're protecting them as you go down. But yeah, for the most part, you know, 2 miles down is where the Bakken or Three Forks, all your different layers are about 2 miles down. So you'll drill and then, you know, vertically, and then you'll go out another 2 miles in the horizontal. The technology available today is pretty incredible. Yeah. And
horizontal drilling, everything else, right?
Absolutely. And it's very, very incredible.
Well, what I found interesting when we went out in your shop is basically you're using the same technology that my grandfather and my father used to make water wells, you know, with just a rod and leathers on the bottom. I don't know if you use leathers. I don't know what you have down there. But
yeah, so the reciprocating rod pumps is by no means a new industry. You're right. I mean, this technology has been around for as long as there have been water wells and oil wells. And it's just, it's that reliable that, you know, there's been some tweaks along the way to improve efficiencies, things like that. But basically, yeah, I mean, a couple check valves, you know, you're pulling fluid on the upstroke and then you're allowing the rods and everything to fall in the downstroke. And then you just keep reproducing that cycle. But yeah, it's very old technology, but yeah, there's a certain recipe in different fields where different metallurgies, whether it be your plunger, your cages, your balls, seats, work better in different environments. And as Jesse mentioned, we're pumping some of the most nasty, you know, between what our downhole environment is from corrosive environments, gases, but also, I mean, we're in North Dakota, right? So, I mean, our surface equipment takes a pounding all winter long too, when it's, you know, at some points minus 40, minus 50 degrees, and not even putting the wind on top of that, right? But basically, if you want to test oil field equipment, send it to North Dakota, and we'll prove it out. And I think it's, you know, not a shot at any people, you know, engineers, who, you know, guys down in Texas. But I remember when the Bakken first started lighting up, engineers would come up and, you know, pushers, rig crews, consultants would come up. Well, I did oil in West Texas, and, you know, this is nothing. Well, they found out in a hurry. This is a lot different pumping environment, you know, and it's amazing that just the different shale plays can produce different results. But, yeah, as far as our business, being, is basically reliant on the reciprocating rod pump, portion, of the industry, majority of all oil wells, I can't remember what the percentage is, but it's 80 to 90% of all wells will end up on a reciprocating rod pump at some portion of its life of that well. that is because as the pressure in the reservoir drop and get down below a certain threshold, the only way to get it is by putting in energy, you know, and a lot of that energy is driven from the system, from the surface, via a rod pump system. So as long as there's wells out here that operators are looking to produce and the price of oil is at a decent enough price point to where they can make money operating that well, they're going to be repairing and putting rod pumps back in the hole.
So Jesse, as director of the operations manager, have you guys thought about using any of your product lines, probably not so much the well side, but your pylon side? Have you guys talked with any government customers at all about using any of these for large scale generators on any installations or anything like that? I mean, you guys are close to an Air Force base up here. So I'm just curious if you guys have thought about expanding outside of that market.
Yeah, I mean, actually, that's Brandon's core product line. He'd probably be better to expand on that, but he is. He's looked extensively outside of the oil and gas industry on a few projects that have come across. And I don't know, Brandon, what do you want to say about that? We haven't really ventured outside the oil field too much. Just the economics didn't seem to be quite there, or we're not set up with the right equipment for some of those projects. But piling's been around for a long, long time as well. And it's used across the country for many different reasons, but I know Brandon was looking at was it a college project?
Yeah, there was a project out east that we bid on, and it was, yeah, I think it was for Valley State University, and yeah, we bid that, and it's just a little bit different price point of, you know, where we're at, you know, here in the oil field versus commercially. So we have tried. It hasn't been successful as of yet, but, you know, we're definitely going to continue looking. We partnered up with another company that they don't like calling themselves brokers or headhunters, but essentially that's kind of what they are, where they're kind of plugged into different markets. And, you know, you partner with them on a commission basis and they try to get you in the door, you know, with MSAs and different things like that to find you work. And, you know, right around the time I felt like we were making some progress, you know, February 2020 happened, and I think we all know what happened there. But But yeah, you know, it definitely got slower. And you know, we were having a hard enough time keeping our guys busy with our core product here in North Dakota. So as things, you know, build back up, yeah, absolutely. I think there's some opportunity out there, but as Jesse mentioned, it may be different, different equipment, different specifications per the job, whatever's needed. We're kind of specialized what we do in the current region. One of our areas that we'd really like to break into would be solar farms, because we've got a piece of equipment here that was actually specifically designed for solar farms and driving piles to support solar panels. So
after this, Dennis and I can definitely hook you guys up with like your local PTAC, your Procurement Technical Assistance Center, to start getting ready to do government jobs, stuff that Dennis and I work on a daily basis. We're more on the DOD side, but there is a ton of stuff. I know where I live down in Pueblo, Colorado, we've got the world's largest solar farm going in right now. So stuff is out there. Dennis, what kind of questions you guys got for you? Because I know it's different. They're not exactly a DOD contractor like we are typically used to, but they're part of the small business ecosystem. So what type of questions do you have for these guys?
Well, Nate, thanks. This has been very interesting. Actually, I don't know anything about oil wells or oil drilling, although I'd like to learn some more. As you guys know, in Colorado, oil wells and fracking have been huge on our agenda here in the state, and always interested in trying to learn more about kind of really how that works and how, you know, different companies fit into that. One of Nate and I's current endeavors is to engage more manufacturers in this ecosystem, because we talk a lot to government prime contractors like Lockheed Martin and Northrop Grumman and guys like that, and then the small government contractors that support them, and that's who our main focus is, as well as service providers, so accountants, lawyers, IT folks, digital marketing people. And then we're starting to get into the manufacturing side a little bit, because if you're a government contractor and you want to create something or build something or make something, you have to start talking to the manufacturers. And I see this kind of as a kind of an offshoot of that. Again, we haven't really spoken much about it, and I like Nate's question about, you know, are there opportunities where you can take what you guys are doing and pivot on it and use it for other areas? And I like also Mr. Mosier's question about, you know, how does this fit in with the water industry, if you will? So I don't have a lot of questions. I'm more thinking about how does this all come together and how does this all fit? And where are you guys? You mentioned earlier about drilling straight down and then over, and I'm assuming you meant that's fracking. Is that what that meant by saying we go 2 miles over as well?
So actually, when the again, this is my disclaimer. I'm not a drilling engineer, but I've been around it.
I've seen people do it on TV.
I'm not even an engineer, so you're doing good.
I can provide my high level.
HBO had a special one time.
Absolutely. So they will, this is just strictly the drilling operation. They will, they've got a drill plan, and they'll drill down 2 miles, and then they'll kick off in what they call the 90, which is essentially what it is. It's a 90-degree turn. But it's gradual, and they, you know, kind of call it a heel because it kind of has a curve to it. And so they'll whatever radius that is, they'll turn from vertical and go horizontal to actually drill, you know, 2 miles down and then 2 miles over, you know, horizontally to encompass as much of the shale rock and stay in that zone. And they'll hover, you know, on their horizontal drilling path, they'll kind of hover within a sometimes five to 10 foot pay zone right in there, and which is pretty incredible. And they'll go in there and, you know, 2 miles, whatever it is, and then after that, that's when they'll come in and frack. So they'll, you know, go down, and a lot of times they'll actually only frack the horizontal portion, which you know, is essentially explosives, you know, down in that. It's kind of a hot topic, in the United States right now. And
but they use water, right? Water pressure to fry.
Yeah. Yep. So a lot of times it's salt water. It's they'll bring in a bunch of basically triplex pumps and create pressure, and basically it's hydraulic fracturing is what it is. And so they'll, you know, create, essentially, it creates a permanent cracks in the reservoir. And a lot of times they'll, well, every time they'll pump in sand with it as well, frack sand. And the sand actually holds the fractures open. So the fluids can flow freely into the wellbore. So not only are they pumping fluid, they're pumping sand to pump into these cracks that is created during the fracturing process.
So there's actually not a screen going this way.
No.
Oh, sorry.
It's radio. People can't see you when you do this.
Oh.
Go ahead, Dennis.
No, I just, so I hear him talking, and I wonder if he realizes what he's saying, because it's really kind of amazing technology, if you will. I guess that's the right word, of how we're doing this. And I don't think most people really even understand it. And I don't want to get into the whole political discussion about fracking and all that. I think it's awesome. I think how we're doing things is just incredibly crazy. And I applaud you guys for the work you're doing. And so on let's go back to your company. So do you guys also have subcontractors that provide parts to you? And you guys go out and fix things basically, right, for the lifts. Do you guys also have vendors that support you? What's the ecosystem like with you guys? What does that look like?
Yeah. Jesse, do you want to hop in and take that one?
Yeah, subcontractors, we do use a few, not a lot. Maybe some welding or delivery contractors. But we do a lot of business with a lot of different vendors. Being an independent pump shop, we can source, the best products from the multiple different manufacturers. And that's kind of nice, because when you're stuck with an OEM, it's a little more challenging to veer out, even though some of the other providers have better products. So we've got a wide, vast array of different vendors, and we're not stuck to just one per se. So a lot of that decision is driven by the customers as well. They'll have certain things that they prefer and they like. So we'll have to, if we pick up a new account, we'll have to figure out what it is that they prefer, and then do our best to source that product.
So you guys are, just kind of comparison from what Nate and I normally do. We both work for a small government contractor. And when I mentioned earlier the primes, so those are, big companies, Lockheed Martin, all that. You guys are kind of in that same boat. You are a small contractor, commercial, in the oil industry. Who are the primes that you guys deal with? Is it like BP? I don't even know who all the big oil companies are out there.
All the majors in the Bakken, from your Continentals to Marathons to the smaller independents, even Oasis, Whiting Petroleum, all the big names in the Bakken. We've got, I think, 17 MSAs in North Dakota.
And you say the Bakken. Can you help with the Bakken? Explain to our listeners what that is. I'm assuming it's an oil field, but not everybody's kind of caught up on everything, including myself.
Yep. So North Dakota is commonly referred to as the Bakken oil field. I believe it's the formation that they're drilling into. And there's, 2011, 2012, it was really taken off up here. 2013-14 was kind of the boom peak. There was, at one point, there was 269 drilling rigs running in North Dakota. Some of the stories of Williston, the boom town, the craziness going on. It's pretty mind-boggling. Today, I've only been up here for a couple of years permanently, but when I came up here, there was about 60 drilling rigs running. The price of oil was, mid-50s, $56, $57 a barrel. And then earlier in the year, it crashed. It went down to like 9 drilling rigs. Today, we're at about 16 drilling rigs in North Dakota. So it's a lot of these wells come in. They make 1,500, 2,000 barrels a day for the first several months flowing, and then they peter off real quick. So
a well that's 2-3 years old may only be making 150-200 barrels a day. So when they stop drilling, the total production kind of falls over on its face, and that's the period we're in right now. Is a lot of people are struggling to keep their production rates up because there's no drilling going on. So it's, what can you do to enhance what you already have? How can we make more out of the wells that are running? Or so that's where some of this bottom hole separation comes into play, and you know, just being creative, coming up with new ideas, ways to eliminate the gas coming through the pump, get more oil production out of each well they have.
So can, if something happens and oil production goes down, do you guys have natural gas with these wells as well? To where
Yes. You
get both in there, right? So natural gas is probably still going to be flowing, even though the crude oil probably goes down. So then would they just convert it over to a natural gas then? Do you guys deal with any of the natural gas side of things?
Not a lot. I mean, as you pump the fluid level down, the well starts making more gas. They have pipelines that take that gas and send it down for compression, get it into big pipelines and send it back east and whatnot. But you'll notice as the price of oil fell on its face, the U.S. total U.S. production has fallen down. Probably it's down to 3-4 million barrels a day. We're down to like a 10-11 million barrels a day total production. So what that's done is actually increased the price of natural gas in the U.S. Because, you know, a lot of wells were shut in. That was a lot of gas production. They're kind of inversely tied to each other. As price of oil goes through the roof, you get a lot more residual natural gas production occurring, and then the market gets flooded with natural gas. As oil wells get shut in, you know, there's a limited supply of natural gas, and then the price of natural gas goes up.
Very interesting. So we are a little bit into this. I'm going to take a quick 30-second break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about, I've got a few questions on how to maybe possibly expand. So give us 30 seconds. We'll be right back. This podcast is brought to you by CHAFA, the Colorado Housing and Finance Authority. Since 1974, CHAFA has strengthened Colorado by investing in community development and affordable housing. CHAFA's community development team partners with lenders across the state to offer the financing you need to grow your business. Talk to your local lender about CHAFA's Cash Collateral Support Program, which helps small and medium-sized businesses access capital that would otherwise be unavailable due to collateral shortfalls. To learn more, visit chfainfo.com. Welcome back to this week's Smallest Cast Podcast. This week we have Elite Lift Solutions here in, where am I? Dickinson, North Dakota. So
you've kind of been all over.
Yeah.
North Dakota.
Yeah, here. It is. It is what it is. So, I mean, no, I am working out of my house and I have my mask on right now. So we're all good. Dennis, so as we were on break there, I was thinking of possible ways to move, to give these guys ideas to move into other realms as well. And one of the things I got to thinking about, every Air Force base that I've worked on, which has been quite a few of them, everyone I've ever visited, they always have like F-16 or fighter jets on pilings. That's one area these guys could probably definitely get into. They have, for you guys, if you guys have never been on an Air Force base, typically on every Air Force base is going to have museums, and they're going to have like F-16s, F-15s, F-22 fighter Raptors all sitting there out front of the museums, and they're all on very large pilings. So there's that. I've been in lots of jobs where we have put very large scale generators on a system that looks almost exactly like what you guys actually have developed. So there's a lot of areas out there, I know, on the government side that you guys could actually get into. I think Dennis and I, we can just help you guys kind of focus on how to get that, right? How to get to it. Because government contracting is quite a bit different than commercial side. Dennis, comments?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know, Nate.
Well, you're not here, so I'll send you a picture of what one of their product lines looks like.
Yeah, I'm trying to. So I was going to ask you guys to if you could give a pitch about your website, but I don't see a website. Do you guys have a website?
We do not have a website yet, but there's been talks about it being in development, and it's yeah. we've been a company for a couple of years now, and I believe someone's working on it in the background. I'll have to check on that for you though. But okay. But we do have a LinkedIn site. It's Elite Lift Solutions on LinkedIn, and we've got some sample pictorial images of some of our driven pile foundations, and so yeah, if you want to get some idea, you can definitely go ahead and add me on there. And
have you guys been approached or thought about maybe getting into any of the geothermal stuff?
Not looked at any geothermal. Yet, no.
That's been a big thing around the country lately is drilling miles deep to get into the geothermal area and use that to heat facilities. So I know I was doing a job out in New Boston, New Hampshire, and the military wanted me to, instead of using white gas or diesel for their heating system of the building that we were installing, they wanted us to look in geothermal. The question was, well, the problem is because anytime an Air Force base has a chance to rebuild something, if they go green, Congress can allocate more money to them and all the everything. So it's a good thing. But in a state like New Hampshire, where it's probably to the core of the earth where it's granite, it's kind of tough to get down to below that granite, see where you can get into the heated earth. So it wasn't really cost effective there. Probably, I think it was going to cost an extra $100 million or something crazy to put in geothermal just to heat their shop. So really wasn't worth it, but it might be another area to look into.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Some of the technologies out there, you know, and who knows, we're a, you know, still a startup, and we're always looking for opportunities to expand in different areas. And yeah, it's so long as we have the subject matter expert that, you know, is willing to, look at that with us, and we have a generally good idea of what the market looks like. We're always open to those things.
So we got a question, Dennis. What's your question?
Well, so I noticed I was going to ask you guys how you got into the oil business, and I know Brandon, I see you're from North Dakota, but is it just kind of a natural flow of things up there, or how did you guys get into oil and gas? And I think Jess said he's pretty recently moved up there. How'd you guys get into that industry?
Yeah, I mean, I think for myself, I've been in it for about 23 years. I went to Michigan Tech up in the UP of Michigan and got a mechanical engineering degree and decided to move out west, and I got out west back in 97 and looked around, and there's mechanical engineer, railroads, we got mining, we've got oil and gas, and so that's how I kind of got into it. But yeah, it's been good. It's a tough business because it is so cyclical, and it's really tough to plan and be on top of the business, but it's a great business. I mean, it's always going to be around no matter what you hear on the news or which direction you think we're going. It's kind of funny with these electric vehicles. I mean, back in 1995 at Michigan Tech, I was in a class. There's a lot of General Motors folks that go to school up there, and our project was to come up, work on the electric vehicle. This was in 1995, and here we are 20 years later, and there's still a lot of challenges with that technology. So
before I let Brandon answer that question as well, I need to say this. So you guys are mechanical engineers. So Dennis, we need to talk a little slower now that we know that. I'm an electrical engineer. Sorry there, Jesse. But so were you electrical first and then you went to mechanical, or were you always mechanical?
I went mechanical 100%. And I had no idea that I was in the oil and gas industry, or I probably would have looked at taking some petroleum classes. But Brandon and myself are mechanicals, and we just went to the oil and gas industry. And luckily, we are both in the production side. So the production side in oil and gas is way more stable than the drilling side. You know, as soon as the oil starts dropping, they lay the rigs over and you're game over for a while. So production's always around, and it is a little more stable of an industry. But yeah, no, for sure. We deal with a lot of petroleum engineers, and, you know, probably educate a lot of drilling engineers on artificial lift and production for sure. But
we all have those classes we wish we would have taken or done differently. In high school, they always wanted me to take more advanced mathematics course. And I'm like, I don't need more advanced mathematics. I'm going to go to school to become an electrical engineer. Well, freshman year was a little different for me. I wish I would have taken those advanced math classes in high school. But so, Brandon, you can ask the question. What got you into the oil and gas industry?
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. And, you know, just a little backstory. It's kind of a running joke in our family. You know, Nate thinks he's got one up on me because he's an EE and I'm an ME. So, you know, that's where that came from there, Jesse. But, and so far there's been
I'm sure Jesse's heard with electrical engineers before. That's the thing.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not the first.
No. And, you know.
For sure.
I'm just waiting for the first industrial engineer to enter my family because then I'll have one up on them. And you know what IE stands for? It's not industrial engineering. It's imaginary engineering. So,
well, you know, I 100%. When I started my engineering degree, there was 85 of us. 4 years later, when I graduated with my bachelor's as a double E, there was 6 of us from that 85. So, and you could literally watch the progression. It went in my school, it went from electrical engineering, then they dropped down to mechanical engineering. And if they couldn't hack that, they dropped down to civil. And then usually instead of either they drop out after that or they'd become business majors. It literally, you could, every single one of them, other 85 people, that's how that was the progression. So.
Yeah, so
absolutely. The only one tougher that I seen was chemical. Chemical was probably the one to get at Michigan Tech.
Yeah, you know, Breaking Bad's a great show. Chemical engineering. So, anyway, so you were going to tell us, how did you want to get in the oil field? Yeah, squirrel.
Squirrel, yeah. Well, absolutely. Went into mechanical engineering at South Dakota School of Mines in Rapid City, South Dakota. Graduated in 2009. And then, you know, it's just kind of funny. You just, in life, if you, you know, leave the door cracked a little bit and you're not closed-minded to, you know, a little bit of being mobile, you know, things happen for you. And, you know, especially with the opportunities that, you know, this great country allows you to move all over the country and try different industries. Right out of college, I went to work for Caterpillar as a design engineer. I worked for a local company here in Western North Dakota as well. Did a lot of design for them. And then moved on to Texas for a little while, where I actually worked with another OEM service provider manufacturer down in East Texas. And eventually it brought me back up to North Dakota because there was a, you know, there's always a tie to Texas and North Dakota and the oil and gas things. And there's opportunities to move, you know, back and forth. So really, you know, I just from the standpoint of a entire system, I really enjoyed that, you know, the oil field had pretty much everything. It had your dynamics of mechanisms, your statics, your, now I'm into geotechnical and soil surveys with driven pile systems, right? And then you even get down to the wellbore itself, and you got fluids, you've got heat transfer, you've got pretty much everything that you learn in engineering school is available for you to navigate and look into in the oil field. So
actually brings me to a question. I typically don't get too technical into this because we got Dennis on the line and he's a CEO. So as the guy working on the pilings, do you do a seismic analysis for each and every location based on soil type and just everything that's in that location?
Yep. So it really comes down to the operator, the end user, whoever we're installing for. If they want to know what the soils are down there. We will come in, we'll bring a, we'll hire a third party geotechnical company to do a pile driving analysis, possibly even a soils boring where they'll go, you know, 50, 60 feet. That way we can get a report, shows the different layers, what's there, and then we can come up with a game plan for what the pile depth and blow counts, everything like that's going to look like.
Okay.
So yeah, we can partner up with those third-party providers to give that initial information. Up here in North Dakota, I'll just give a general analysis that, you know, the reason why driven piles are so successful and have been successful in North Dakota is because of the freeze-thaw cycles, right? So in North Dakota, you know, you've got extreme cold in the winter, and then in the spring everything thaws. Well, if your equipment, you know, that weigh may weigh 1 to 200,000 pounds, you know, depending on what it is, it's a heavy piece of equipment. Just like, you know, the sidewalk, you know, heaves in the winter, and you know, that's exactly what we deal with out there. But by installing driven piles, deep earth foundation, if you will, we're able to get past that, you know, 5-6 feet of frost, and drive that pile down to bedrock. And sometimes it's, you know, 20 feet, sometimes it's 30, some we've driven as far as 120 feet per pile before, just to hit that bedrock to where you're able to support that load.
So does the earth still heave around those piles and the pile stay still? Is that how it works?
That's kind of the idea, is that basically the earth it can move sometimes, you know, a couple inches, and it just moves around the piles, and we're using basically pipe piles, open pipe piles. We can use other shapes, but primarily that's what we've found that's been effective. And the earth just basically moves around that pile, and wherever that platform is, if your platform is 2 feet above ground, you know, because we keep a little bit of an air gap typically between the ground and the bottom of our foundation, to where the ground can move up and down and your foundation stays true to the world. And you're not resetting equipment, you know, every year. And that's one of the issues that we you know, over time have seen, that these operators every spring, they're having to reset their equipment, you know, redo the dirt work that they, you know, spent a lot of time. And another advantage to driven piles all year round is we can come and pound pipe, you know, whether it's February, you know, minus 30, or if it's July and 100 degrees, where we can come install that foundation. Now, trying to install a similar foundation with an earthen type substrate in February, you're talking about massive heating blankets. It gets expensive. You're going to have to excavate down below that frost line and build up your foundation that way. So it's a fairly clean setup that we can do all year round, and the operator they don't have to change their procedure, you know, and hurry and rush and get all their equipment installed in the summer, and then they don't do anything all winter. It allows them the opportunity to continue their pace throughout the year, regardless of what the weather is.
So Dennis, if you look on their LinkedIn page, or I'll send you a photo as well, but really what he's talking about is, so the oil pumping rig, is that what you call it? I mean, what do you call that?
I think the official, you know, if I'm gonna get technical, it's a pumping unit. Everybody has a different name for it,
but so it's the unit that you, if you've ever been in oil or driving through the United States and you see a unit that looks like a, I don't know, a bird up and goes up and down, the head goes up and down. Real technical term there. That's essentially what they put on top. So instead of putting that on the ground, like I've seen most of them actually traveling, most of them, especially down in Texas, stuff like that, they're like on the ground. Those pumping units are just on the ground, maybe on a concrete base on the ground, but it's on the ground. So Dennis, what they've got here is they drill pilings in the ground, and then they've got preformed or precast concrete foundations that they just lay on top. They weld them to the pilings, and then the pumping equipment attaches to the top of that foundation. So it gets everything up and off the ground completely, so it can't really move.
Yeah, and one thing that we're able to do by, you know, fixing everything by, you know, welding or somehow fixing everything to the piles that are driven in the ground is designed for different case loads, right? So if a customer would come in and say, hey, we need this system to meet our specifications, so we need to design to certain codes for like a, you know, 60, 70, 80, 90 mile an hour wind, right? By having driven piles that actually have some adhesion to the ground, we're able to design that in. Now, if you just had a slab that was sitting on grade, you'd really, without having some mechanism to attach that to the ground permanently, you wouldn't be able to meet those specifications from the customer.
No, you have to go. I mean, so I used to design and build ground-based satellite tracking stations, and our foundations for our antennas that were, I mean, lots and lots of different forces, because these antennas are moving at, you know, 18 degrees per second, and they're really zipping around. But those things, our foundations would go 30 to 40 feet in the ground. So the hole we dig is massive, and massive amounts of concrete. And but this system looks very, very interesting. So Dennis, what kind of questions you got?
I'm still reeling a little bit from all of this. I haven't looked a whole lot into the whole oil industry, and perhaps that's somewhere you and I need to talk to some companies here in Colorado as well. This is all really fascinating. I've been spending a few minutes here while we're talking, kind of looking at the Bakken oil field. There's a lot of discussion here about ethane and how that's all coming, gas coming off it. But it's a huge oil field. I didn't realize it was that big out in it's really Montana, North Dakota, and in Canada. I appreciate you guys coming on today. This was fascinating for me, especially being here in Colorado. We do have, you know, similar kind of backgrounds as far as the states go with the whole oil industry and all that entails. But fascinating stuff. And really glad you guys came on. It got me thinking about a lot of different things. And I learned something today, so I appreciate it, especially the day after Thanksgiving. But I did learn something today, and I appreciate it. Does Brad have anything? I want to know if Brad had any more questions.
Yeah, I do. I found it interesting, and I would like to know. I'm kind of one that always look toward the future. Right now, the oil industry, the monetary end of it is way down, and we all know, no matter who's in the big office in Washington, we're all going to need gas and we're going to need oil. This is not going to be a automatic switch over to sunlight and wind. So eventually this is going to come back and the demand for oil is going to get greater. How are you guys planning? Are you planning future expansions, future use of money as it comes in?
Let's go with Jesse.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of different avenues we can get into within production. Right now, in our first couple of years, we've just focused on our core, which what we're experienced level is very good at. But there's roughly 13 different forms of artificial lift, for instance. The rod pumps is just one of them. And so, you know, we do have experience in other forms of lift. You're absolutely right. The fundamentals is going to drive the market, free market. And as soon as the supply on hand in Cushing, Oklahoma falls down, the prices will go back up and get the airplanes flying again. And, you know, it's been a cycle for the last 23 years that I've been in it. So there's definitely opportunities to expand within the oil field. There's a ton of things you can do out there. So the piling has a lot of opportunities in the northern ice belt states. You won't find it in the Colorado or the Texas or Oklahoma fields because it's you know, it's just not quite as price competitive to do one of those compared to sitting in on the dirt. But yeah, I mean, where the market takes us. I was down in the Colorado market for 5-6 years, and I know that market quite well. And yeah, it's similar, but it's definitely this is much bigger scale and more challenging. And you know, if you do a good job, it all comes down to customer service and providing what the customer wants. And so that's what we're focused on right now. But we do have plans to expand into other artificial lift methods. Yep.
I have one more question for you guys that have been around these wells. Apparently oil wells drilling in the Bakken's, what, about 10 years old now? what's the life expectancy and how long do they pump?
Well, I mean, there's been legacy oil wells that were drilled in the 40s and 50s in North Dakota that they still have pumps going up and down. And there's a lot of wells that took off up here in the early 80s that are still operating. The wells that were drilled in the last 10 years, you know, they'll be pumping those for probably another 10 to 15 years, I would say, before a lot of them start getting abandoned. But yeah, they do phenomenal the first couple of years, and then they peter off, and then they're pretty steady at, you know, 250 barrels a day, in that range for quite some time. They'll keep producing.
So these old wells, do they reclaim the ground and the area around them? Does the property go back to the previous owner?
Yep, there's actually companies that just do nothing but plug and abandon. They call it plug and abandon the well, reclaim it. The producers have to set bonds aside before they even start drilling. That is money that is set aside with the state to put that land back to pristine condition when that well is done producing. So, yep, there's all kinds of reclaiming going on all the time.
Is EPA being a real pain up here too?
Not so much in North Dakota. Like I said, I spent 5 years in Colorado. I spent 15 in Wyoming. I've seen a lot more of the EPA regulations affecting specifically Wyoming, where it was a lot of BLM land. And then Colorado, you've got a lot of private land. North Dakota is all private land for the most part. I would say 80% of it's all private leases. So there's a lot less red tape to get through when you're drilling on private land than there is federal land.
I guess that's why it makes it lucrative for the landowner. It's easy, right, to just offer them funds to say, for the next 20 years, this is what I'm going to give you every month or whatever percentage.
And,
yeah, you hear some of these success stories of these people that held on to their mineral rights, and you know their first check is, you know, several hundred thousand dollars, and thereafter, and you know
they actually had a show on Discovery Channel, Backyard Oil Rigs or something like that.
Yeah,
these guys were putting these little teeny tiny pumps. They were about the size of a, I don't know, like a little shed, like a 10-foot by 10-foot shed, just a tiny pump, and with that alone, this guy was getting literally like a check for like $50,000 a month. Just off of that. And it was just a tiny, tiny well. And he's like, we don't even know it's there anymore. I mean, it just sits there and we just collect the money. So anybody that's out there wants to drill in Colorado, call me. I've got an acre and a half. That's plenty of space to put a small well on. I'll even help dig the hole. So, okay. So we are like 50 some minutes into this. So
yeah, I will just say one thing. Brad, you had asked about, you know, the current price of oil and everything like that. You know, we've seen this before. You know, I'm young in my oil field career, and we'll see what, you know, where this career takes me. But, you know, one thing we've seen is you just got to ride the, you know, in the oil field, it's called you ride the roller coaster, right? It's, you know, you celebrate when you're high, and then, you know, in the peaks and valleys, you know, hopefully you've done well enough in the peaks that you can withstand the valleys, and we're coming out of this. You know, it's oil will be back. I don't know at what point. The other thing to mention is, you know, a downturn, yeah, nobody really wants to see oil hit the very bottom, but what it allows these operators and service companies to do when things really, really the bottom drops out is get more efficient. And I know, you know, when things were blowing and going, like Jesse had mentioned earlier, you know, back in 2012, 13 into 14, people are just throwing money at it, you know, and, you know, they didn't really care. We had $120 oil and, you know, efficiency was the last thing on everybody's mind. But now, you know, the cost of drilling a well, the cost to service a well, different things, in the market have actually, good things have dropped out of it, from an efficiency standpoint. It, you know, aside from just needing, oil, you know, gasoline, different petroleum products, I mean, plastics. I mean, it's, I mean, it, I don't think plastic is going away anytime soon, right? I mean, you've seen everything you buy nowadays is made of plastic, right? And, you know, whether, you know, it's good for the environment or not, you know, hopefully we're doing our due diligence and protecting our environment and recycling, doing the good things that we need to do. But, you know, the oil does more than just drive your vehicle and fly airplanes, right? So it's, it'll come back. It'll come back to the point where, you know, we'll be riding another peak and then, you know, hopefully get ready for the next valley.
And so, in that case, it's not a whole lot different than what Dennis and I do, our industry. Our industry is DOD contracting, right? So DOD contracts, for us, it's 100% related to whoever is in the White House. So one side of the coin, DOD funding goes up. The other side of the coin, DOD funding gets cut. So when DOD funding gets cut, they have to start making cuts across the entire ecosystem. So, it's kind of the same way. It's either hit or miss, either it's good or it's bad. Thankfully for the last few years, it's been really good. We'll keep moving forward. So Brandon, you guys said you guys are on LinkedIn. You don't have a website yet. Do you guys have a phone number people can get a hold of you guys on that you'd be willing to give out?
Yeah, I'll have to get the number for our Williston office is where our main administrators are. So, okay. Yes, we do have a phone number.
So while Brandon's looking that up, Jesse, any final words of wisdom or anything you guys want to say about the business?
No, it's I was in a large business for a long time, and now we're in a smaller business, you know, 30, 40 people. So it's interesting for me to do the small business. It's a lot more enjoyable in many different ways. You wear a lot more hats, but it's, you learn a lot more, and it's a great team of people to be around. So I'm really enjoying it. And anybody that's got any questions about the Williston product, they can call me at 701-713-5660, and be glad to see if we can work together.
Excellent. Well, we appreciate everything today, Jesse. And Brandon, do you have that other number?
Yeah, our main Williston office is area code 701-572-4620.
Excellent. So, we're going to put this stuff out for you guys on our website as well, your information. So, Dennis, any parting words of wisdom from you?
No, I just want to say thank you guys again. This was very interesting. We don't typically get in this industry, and so this was actually a highlight for me for this week. I learned a lot, and I appreciate you guys taking the time to talk to us on this long weekend, and hope you guys have a great rest of the weekend.
Yes, so Brandon, thanks for inviting us into the office here and taking a look, and Brad, thanks for giving your half a cent. Appreciate that.
Well, you know, I don't have any engineering degree, so I must be way down there.
No, you're probably the smarter one. You never had large loans to pay off after college.
Give me experience over a piece of paper.
Hey, we'll put you in the same bucket that Dennis is in.
There you go.
He doesn't have an engineering degree either.
There you go.
But that's okay. Dennis is our business development guy.
I went to the School of Hard Knocks.
There you go. Which you go. Really doesn't exist anymore if you look at it. So, okay, well, with that being said, I want to say thanks one last time. And with that, we will chat again next week on the Smallest Cast podcast. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks for listening.
You've reached the end of another episode of the Smallest Cast podcast. Connect with us at thesmallest.org. Don't forget to sign up to our newsletter to receive our free materials. See you at the next episode. See you at the next episode.